A four-part class series begins on these four bodhisattva ways of embrace. It would be one translation of this essay by Dogen Zenji. Dogen, our 13th century Japanese founder of Soto Zen. Kind of short, sweet essay by Dogen that's pretty straightforward as far as Dogen's teachings go on how bodhisattva practices. And since we have 4 weeks and there's four methods, practices, maybe we divide it up like that. Dogen has a lot to say about giving, though, so we might not make it all the way through the practice of giving today. Giving's a big practice. And I thought before getting into Dogen's fascicle, I'd just mention some of the background on these four practices. Dogen did not make up these four. It's an old Indian Mahayana teaching that's taught in the Prajnaparamita Sutras. So this set of four practices looks like it arose sometime around the time of Christ, around the year zero, or first century in the world, in India. And it was part of this movement of the Mahayana, the great vehicle, the bodhisattva path of practicing for the benefit of all beings. And most of you probably have heard of the six paramitas, the six perfections, the six bodhisattva practices of going beyond. And this is kind of the classic path of the bodhisattva, whose bodhisattva lives for the benefit of all beings. And these six paramitas are giving, same, begins with giving, just like this list begins with giving. Giving, or generosity, ethical conduct, the precepts of practice, not harming others, that's the second one. Patience, or patient acceptance of suffering and harm and so on. The fourth one is diligence or enthusiastic effort. The fifth is meditative concentration, like zazen. And the fifth is wisdom or prajna paramita, the perfection of insight into the reality of all things. Particularly the understanding of how everything is empty of what we think it is. So these six paramitas, you could say it's in the Mahayana, which is the great vehicle, the bodhisattva path of which Zen is a part. These six are like the entire practice. I think it's always nice to remember that when we wonder what's the practice, these six include everything. Again, giving, ethical discipline or virtue, patience, enthusiasm or diligence, concentration, and wisdom. All working together all the way to complete perfect awakening of a Buddha. So these six practices arose also in these Prajnaparamita Sutras in the first century, and yes?
Just define paramita.
Paramita is like, we often translate it as perfection, but it means like these practices which go beyond themselves, for short, we could say like that. Sometimes they're, in one of our translations here, they're called transcendences, the six transcendences. But done just like as they sound, as we just listed them, they're just practices. And when they go beyond the separation of self and other, that's when they become transcendent or perfection or gone beyond, when they go beyond duality. So those six are the classic bodhisattva practices that many people have probably heard of, but we maybe haven't heard of these other four, which are often their looking into the sutras, they're often grouped together. Like after these six, there's these other four bodhisattva methods. So it's kind of like a little addendum to the six paramitas. Sometimes it's said the six paramitas are for like cultivating one's own practice, and these four that Dogen's going to talk about are like particularly for others. Of course, all these practices are both benefit oneself and others, but sometimes they're broken down that way. And they nicely make a list of 10 if you add together the six and the four, which is maybe part of why the six were expanded like this. So in one of these handouts here, these are in Sanskrit, they're called Samgraha Vastu. So we could translate Dogen's essay too as like the Bodhisattva Samgraha Vastu. Samgraha means gathering or holding or assembling or collecting or attracting. And it says on this handout. And Vastu just means like place, thing, or object. So it's like the things that gather, the things that assemble or collect. And as we'll see in here, it looks like it's particularly for gathering sentient beings, particularly humans, but gathering beings into the Dharma in order to help them. Or we could even say that gathering a sangha together. These are the four ways of gathering a sangha together. That's not brought out in Dogen's presentation, but that's it looks like the original meaning of this Samgraha Vastu. As you can see in the I put the Chinese characters here under Samgraha Vastu. It's the same Chinese characters as Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance. That's Dogen's Chinese, and just a little bit on the Chinese here. These first four characters are just transliteration of the Sanskrit, Bodhisattva, which is the Chinese way of transliterating Bodhisattva. So the next character means four. The number four, right? And then the last character means dharmas or like methods or practices. So the main character in this list that's I think of interest is the next to the last one from the right, and that's the one that means like to gather. That's the one that translates samgraha, and so it means to gather or to collect. And it's the same character that we use for seshin. So seshin means to like gather or collect the mind. Shin is mind or heart. So seshin is the name of our like a week-long meditation retreats to kind of gather and collect the heart and mind into one suchness. Right? So kind of nice in a way that the formal name of our Zen retreats is to gather the mind. And it's also the same character here is used in the three pure Bodhisattva precepts. So when we say, I vow to embrace and sustain standards of conduct, or right conduct. I vow to embrace and sustain all good. I vow to embrace and sustain all beings. That embrace and sustain is the same character. It's the second one from the right of that string of Chinese characters. The second one from the right is can be pronounced setsu. So in seshin, se is like abbreviation of setsu. Setsshin, seshin, and it can also be pronounced sho. In this case, it's bodhisattva shisho ho. In the precepts, it's pronounced sho. So embrace and sustain is a kind of a nice translation too. As often in the Chinese language, the words are quite dynamic, right? So this character means collect, gather, it also means to embrace, which is pretty similar to collect and gather, embrace, and it means to also sustain. So we could also translate sashin as like embracing and sustaining the mind. Yeah. A little etymology, a little Chinese lesson here on how characters are constructed. The left-hand side of that character, if you have good eyes, the left-hand side is we call a radical, is part, and it means hand. That one that has like a vertical line with two crosses on it. If you take that just on its own, it means hand. And then you see there's three other like shapes to the right of it. Can you follow here? We're looking at this same character, but breaking it into parts. The three identical shapes. Or radicals, and that particular shape means, it can mean ear, but it can also mean like edge or border. So I think that the etymology, just like English etymology of Chinese here, it's like it's a hand with three edges or borders. So it's like the hand. I at least I haven't heard this, but I looking at it, I kind of picture it as like the hands that are like pulling in from all the different borders and sides. They're gathering in all the edges into one whole. You picture that? It's like collecting the edges with your hands, gathering into the center. So that's kind of the meaning of that Chinese character. Embrace, sustain, gather, collect. So Kaz Ta-Nehisi translates this as Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance, but that's a very loose translation. Really more like the Bodhisattva's four, I think I translated it as four ways of embrace, because it's actually gathering beings. It's gathering living beings together into the Dharma to help them. One other translation of Dogen's title by Nishijima Roshi is the four elements of a bodhisattva's social relations. So this is again understanding the Sanskrit original meaning, which we'll go into. Thomas Cleary's translation is the four integrative methods of bodhisattvas. Just kind of similar to gathering, integrating beings. So this is how Chinese is, right? Three of the translators, just from the Indian sutras, they don't have that Chinese character. They're coming from the Samgraha, and the understood meaning of this is Robert Thurman translates it as the four social practices. Edward Kanze translated it as the four means of conversion, to convert living beings to Dharma. Maybe a little bit loaded term, but it looks like the meaning is something like this kind of like drawing. Another teacher's translation is the four means of drawing sentient beings into the Dharma, drawing them into the Dharma. So on this handout, if you don't have it, you can just listen in. Samgraha Vastu, and you can read on your own. I put the Sanskrit names for these four practices that Dogen will speak of: giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and equality action. And you can see the Chinese and the Sanskrit. And then there's this excerpt from the Large Sutra on Perfect Wisdom here, where he defines these four. Mostly he talks about giving. In this sutra, the Bodhisattva gives material gifts and Dharma gifts. And that's kind of a classic way of breaking down in the kind of classifications of the paramitas and so on. Giving is generally seen as material giving, is the obvious one, but also giving Dharma teachings that help beings become free from suffering. Sometimes a third one is added in, of giving fearlessness or giving protection from fear. But in these sutras, they just list these two, material giving and dharma giving. And then I won't read this whole thing here, but the Buddha in the sutra talks about the material giving of gold, silver, horses, and elephants, and so on. But I did think this was a little bit interesting that he says, after he gives these things, gives away gold, silver, horses, and elephants, he says to the people, "Hey, you people, come along. As I have not held on to these things, so also do you give them up." Which sounds a little bit like the Bodhisattva gives away these things and says, I'm not holding on to them now. You can give them up too. Or pass them along. Pass on the gifts. And then giving them precepts. We call our Jukai ceremony literally can be translated as giving or conferring the precepts. Gives, which is interesting that that's still called like a kind of material gift, actually. And then within the dharma, there's kind of worldly, sort of mundane dharmas, which don't sound that mundane. They're like various teachings about how to live and be happy. But then the kind of transcendent dharmas, we might say, or holy dharmas, it says here, is the teachings that directly lead to complete liberation. So they're making those classifications too in these sutras. But I did, so you can read that on your own, the sutra. But the other place that it seems to be where these are, they don't appear like all over the place. You know, we have many of these Indian texts are in English now, and they're pretty easy to search for these things. It looks like the main Indian source for these, for the kind of exposition of these four practices, is in the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara, which is translated into English by Robert Thurman. His translation is the Universal Vehicle Discourse Literature, but he can call it the Ornament of Mahayana Sutras. And it's a kind of commentary by Maitreya and or Asanga. So maybe last class series we did sometime recently, we did on Asanga's Bodhisattva precepts. So some of you might have been there. Asanga's the 4th century founder of the Yogacara school of Buddhism. And wrote many, many works about Bodhisattva practice as well as mind-only teachings. So this is really about Bodhisattva practices by Asanga.
Just say the name of it again.
The Mahayana Sutra Alamkara. Alamkara means like adornment or like ornament. Yeah, they string them all together. So,
how is that different than the adornment of the mind sutra, or the
flower adornment?
No, I should remember it because I studied it a lot, but the
another Asanga teaching?
Yeah. The one that Rab did for so many years at Greenbelt.
Well, there's the sutra, the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra,
yes.
He taught.
Yeah.
And so that was a really important sutra for Asanga. And actually, I did find these four practices are listed in that sutra, but they're not defined. They're just, but it makes one mention of them, of so they're in there, but not defined.
So this is the 4th century. This commentary.
Yeah.
But you think the origin is around the turn of the century?
the origin of the term.
The term
Samgraha Vastu. These four bodhisattva methods looks like that. These four bodhisattva practices that Dogen's commenting on arose in the world in India around the first century. In the Prajnaparamita Sutras and other sutras.
So you see them in those.
Yeah, you see them in those sutras. And in fact, this is the quote on from this Prajnaparamita Sutra that's around the first century AD. And which is pretty, you know, there's a whole commentary on the four of them. But then later, a few centuries later, Asanga is like kind of like bring out his own kind of like commentary on these four practices. And it's the most like extensive thing I've found that's like kind of talks about what they mean, which is interesting because I don't know if Dogen ever read that actually. Dogen gets a lot of his stuff from the Chinese sources where they maybe list these four, but he maybe didn't read this commentary because it's pretty different. The things Dogen picks up on are pretty different than the things Asanga picks up on. So that's why I thought it would be nice to just see what Asanga says first. It gives a little different slant than Dogen. So it's this very... What should I say about this Indian language of Asanga writing these treatises? Almost like a legalistic sort of language. It's very like, you know, lists of things and highly structured. So it's kind of like dry, but if you pull out some of the pieces. So there's these verses on the social practices, which is a translation of this four methods of embrace. Which here, you see at the bottom of the page, is translated here as giving, pleasant speech, accomplishment of aims, which is beneficial practice, and consistency of behavior. So I think this fourth one is the one that's really, I think, is really interesting and different from Dogen. Doesn't really pick up on this. In the Indian version, it's like this fourth practice is kind of like, we might say in modern times, practicing what you preach. You know, or setting an example. Dogen doesn't really talk about it that way. So just a little bit on page 2 of this Samgraha Vastu, where these verses, generosity or giving, dana, we say, and many of you know the word dana in Pali and Sanskrit, that's the word for, means giving, right, generosity, is considered the same as above. So in his earlier commentary, when he's talking about the six paramitas, it's like, same. pleasant speech, accomplishment of aims, and consistency of behavior are considered as teaching those transcendences, is the translation of paramitas, we could say perfections, to people, inspiring them to practice and setting an example accordingly. So generosity is giving material and dharma gifts. Pleasant speech teaches the paramitas. So I thought that's kind of like, that's in this commentary. Of course, Dogen will say it includes all kinds of kind speech and greeting each other kindly. But in this Indian definition of kind speech, it kind of narrows it down to like, well, what's the really kind speech? Teaching these paramitas. That's really kind speech. That's like the definition of it, right? Teaching bodhisattva practices is what pleasant or kind speech is. Accomplishment of aims inspires people. He'll talk about that more. Therefore, one teaches these paramitas and inspires people to practice the paramitas. So, Dogen calls beneficial practice in this Indian model means practicing the paramitas, and which inspires other people to practice them. Practicing giving and ethical conduct and patience and diligence and meditation and wisdom. Consistency of behavior or setting the example refers to practicing oneself what one has recommended to others. So it's quite clear there that it really does mean this, this setting the example, practicing what one preaches, and so on. That's what we call, what Dogen, or, you know, Kaz Ta-Nehisi basically translates as identity action. And I just think it's interesting that Dogen plays with this whole identity action in a very Zen-like way. But it looks like the original meaning of identity action means practicing identically as what one's teaching. See, where he goes with that.
That was different than accomplishment of aims. Wasn't that also practicing?
It's similar, but I think accomplishment of aims or beneficial practice is to just do these practices that are beneficial just because they're beneficial and to practice them. And the fourth is maybe it's those same things, same activities, but now the reason that we're doing it is to set the example for others rather than just because they're good in themselves. Almost
to inspire others.
Although I think it said the third was inspiring others. And maybe the fourth is just it's just making this point that it's not adding anything new in terms of practice, but it's just saying if we really want to gather the Dharma assembly and we're teaching something but we're practicing something completely different, it's not going to really work. I think it's kind of and it's just emphasizing that as a whole fourth practice. Yes.
And what becomes interesting is then, because then we're really narrowing down to just giving in kind speech.
Yeah.
And then consistent, and then the third and fourth are kind of consistency with that.
You could say it like that. Yeah.
In a way, it's wow, really powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah,
giving and kind speech are kind of singled out, and especially giving, in the sutra thing, it only has one sentence on each of the other three, but it has a whole page about giving. Kind speech is a kind of giving too, right? So you could say, really, the practice is just giving, and then that includes giving with our kind speech, and then the beneficial practices are is just giving. I mean, the commentary says the other five paramitas also. Or maybe we could say, really, it's all giving. And then, the fourth is setting the example of giving. And also we could say that kind speech is teaching giving, right? Mm-hmm. There's giving, there's teaching giving, there's practicing giving, and then there's setting the example of giving is because that's what we taught.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. So in the context of giving, when I first heard you say identity action, it sort of reminded me of our new additions to the meal chant, where there's no difference between giver, receiver, and gift.
Yeah.
Is that implying identity action? You know, in my activity of giving, how is my giving different than the receiver of the gift itself, and, that whole thing?
I would say that part of the meal chant, and for those who haven't heard this verse, it says, it's when we're opening the eating bowls, and the verse is, may all beings realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. So they're the three spheres. The emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift means that, you can't find the giver separate from the receiver, there's only a giver when there is a receiver, right?
Yeah.
You can't give if there's no receiver, and you can't receive if there's no giver, and there can't be a gift unless there's a giver and a receiver. So it's a nice example of how those three are completely interdependent. If you took one away, that the other two couldn't exist. So because these three are interdependent, they're empty of independent existence. There's no independent giver apart from a receiver. So it's a nice teaching about what emptiness means, actually. So the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift, I would say that is what makes giving a paramita. So there's the practice of giving, when I'm going to give something to you, and that's called giving. But for it to be dana paramita, for it to be the perfection or transcendence of giving, In the old sutras, that's defined as when you're giving without the sense of separation between the giver and the receiver and the gift. So it's like while realizing the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift, you still actually practice giving. That's the transcendent giving. So the identity action, I think Dogen kind of like talks about it a little bit like that. But again, in the original identity action, it's more like I better just like, you know, if I'm gonna say recommend some practice, then I better practice it. Makes it very hard for Dharma teachers. Yeah. Why are these considered the four social practices? In verse 74 here, there's a beneficial art, means of holding, impeller, and example. So just for your information, where these numbered verses here, that's like Asanga writing the verse, and he writes these really dense verses. And then Asanga's student, Vasubandhu, who's one of our Zen ancestors, Vasubandhu Daiyosho, he's the one who, like the little indent part, that's Vasubandhu's commentary on his teacher Asanga's verse. They both lived in like the 4th century. So generosity is a beneficial art because by giving worldly goods, physical benefit arises. Pleasant speech, kind speech, is a means of holding because it enables the uneducated to understand a perplexing notion. So it sounds like, again, it sounds like it's talking about teaching the paramitas. In this case, kind speech is educating. And we might say, well, what about the kind speech of just saying, oh, how are you doing? Which Dogen mentions this type of kind speech. We could maybe say that's kind of educating people too. That's a kind of teaching, like when somebody's kind of caught up in their own little world and somebody, oh, how are you doing? It's kind of like it opens them to, teaches them something larger, right, about interconnectedness. Fulfilling aims is an impeller because it impels people toward virtue. I guess an impel means to like send people towards, right?
Is compel?
I think, I don't know, does anyone know impel? Like pushing.
It's more an invitation than a push.
Oh, okay, an invitation or push, yeah. Or pull.
A pull would be more of a compel.
So maybe we could say like encouraging people toward virtue. And consistency in practice is an example because when they see that the one involved practices as she teaches, they are motivated to engage in virtue and conform to that example. So very straightforward commentary, but that's particularly this fourth one. When I first saw that, I thought, I was so surprised because whenever I've heard people teach Dogen's thing, that's never brought up because these are kind of obscure Indian sources. But but it's a wonderful teaching, I think, for bodhisattvas, right? It's like, and keeps us humble, even if we're just encouraging people. It's about like not being a hypocrite, right? It's so easy to be hypocritical. So even if we're encouraging, oh, did you really need to say that to that person? That wasn't that a little bit harsh? We might help somebody in that way, encourage their bodhisattva practice, but then 5 minutes later we say something harsh to somebody else. So it's hard to encourage or kind of correct people and do this in a way where we're consistent with what we're saying. I find that the more I practice, the harder it is to kind of like be self-righteous, maybe we'd say. It still can happen, of course, but I think of when I first started practice, I was really into like all of the ways that other people could improve themselves. And practice better, right? You know. And it's not so, no, it's fun to kind of like see how I could be working on my practice. Because I'm already like, you know, doing something at least. These other people should, you know, at least like catch up to me or something, right? So this is the problem. Yeah, the patience. And the humility to see like, I'm still, you know, I do feel like the more I practice, the more it feels like there's there's infinite depth to this, right? There's so much more I could deepen this practice, and maybe then it becomes mostly like just trying to practice myself, and may that be an example. And then, of course, then we have classes like this sometimes too, but hopefully that can be an encouragement too. But maybe the main thing for all of us really is to just do our practice, just keep practicing, whether or not anyone knows it's calls it practice.
I'm wondering if this fourth one maybe relates to like the class we did at Tassajara about the bodhisattva unselfishness is so extreme. I mean, it's out of reach.
To be completely selfless? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this fourth one then speaks to in terms of the consistency.
Mm. Yeah, in a way it's maybe the hardest of them all, right? And the more thoroughly we're practicing the first three, the harder it is to practice the fourth, right? But yet, that's the direction. It's the direction we want to go. I think with all of these, they're infinite. And same with the paramitas, there's no end. It's not like, okay, I finished giving, finished ethical conduct. There's no end. And it's just ever deepening. But I think this fourth one's a nice one to look at, is how am I consistent? I wasn't here, but I listened to Nettie's talk a couple weeks ago on a Wednesday night. And she was speaking of something like this. Is she looking at places in her life where she feels like, I'm not being kind of consistent with my values. Maybe not so much what I'm teaching others, but with my own values, and nobody else is notices actually, but I want to be like, it's a little different maybe because there's really like an internal consistency. I want to be like in accord with my own values, and I feel like I can't really hide from myself like that. This is maybe more about this way of drawing together the Sangha of like wholeheartedness and integrity. But it could be on an individual level too, I think. Consistency in practice just within one's own teaching oneself and practicing oneself. So verse 75, through the first, meaning giving, one becomes receptive. I think that means the assembly, the other beings that we're trying to practice in accord with. When we're giving, that's how I would take it, others become more receptive. Through kind speech, others become more devoted. Through beneficial action, others really start practicing those practices. And through this consistency, identity action, there's purification. Maybe we mean the true purification of our complete integrity. Or through giving worldly goods, others become receptive. It's like, I don't have time for like listening to some Dharma stuff now. I just want my next meal, okay? And so we give people a meal, and then they become, oh, okay, now I'm like comfortable and a little more, I have a place to live and some food. I have my basic needs are met. Now, what next? what am I going to do with my life? Maybe there's a way to live that's more and more free from suffering and more benefiting others. So I think that's one way in all spiritual traditions why there's, you know, material giving, fulfilling basic material needs first. People aren't going to really, like, get into the more spiritual considerations if they're looking for their next meal. Through kind speech, pleasant words, one comes to have faith in the teaching because one's doubts are resolved and the meaning made clear. Through fulfilling being's aims, beneficial practice, one practices according to the teaching. I think it means that those hearing, those watching it. Through consistency of behavior, one perfects one's practice through perseverance over a long time. As you said, somebody said patience. This one. This is the activity of these social practices. Or means of conversion. So, again, you can read the rest on your own. It's more of these Indian classifications. So, turning to Dogen, Bodhisattva Shishoho, the Bodhisattva's four embracing dharmas. I guess dharma here could mean, like, you know, dharma with capital D. We sometimes says means teachings. The four teachings on gathering the assembly or embracing sentient beings. Or dharma with small D can mean, like, methods or practices. Dharma is one of those very dynamic terms. The Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. Giving means non-greed, which is used, like, in the precepts, the Bodhisattva precepts. We have the eighth precept is not being possessive. So that's the same thing here. Not being possessive means giving. Giving means not being possessive. So there's, like, a positive and a negative. I think that's an interesting way to define giving, actually, right from the outset. What does giving mean? Giving means non-greed, or non-stinginess, non-possessiveness. Non-greed means not to covet. Not to covet means not to curry favor or, you know, flatter others in order to get something. I think curry favor, right, means to, like, a little bit doing something nice, but to get something for ourselves. Is that what you say curry favor means?
Giving to get.
Giving to get, yeah. So there's a nice full definition of what giving means to Dogen. It means non-greed, non-possessiveness, not coveting, not giving with the intention just to get something for ourselves, not really wholehearted giving. So much could be said about giving. But I think particularly to put it as not so much, I like this kind of negative way of saying it's just not being greedy, because giving might mean, like, well, I'm here and I'm feeling, like, pretty open and connected, but maybe I should be doing something more. Not to say that sometimes that's okay, that's, you know, it could be helpful to think that way, but this way it could be, like, it just means you're, like, you're not being possessive. It means you're, like, ready to give because you're not holding on. So you might just be, like, it might be not such an outwardly active giving. It might be like zazen, for example. It could be like, I'm just sitting here, just really spacious and open, and I feel just like I'm not really holding on to anything. I'm practicing letting go. Often zazen, we say, is just whatever we're grasping in the mind during zazen, we just let go, release, let go, relax, open. And that kind of mind is like the mind of giving. Yeah. It's not being greedy for some other experience than we're having at this moment of zazen. Just this experience right now is perfectly complete, is a kind of giving. And Dogen will talk that way some too. Even if you govern the four continents, you should always convey the correct teaching with non-greed. Or you should always teach and transform the true way with non-greed. Which sounds like just being not greedy is actually teaching the true way. Right? It's not like now you should start teaching the true way, but without greed. It's just, that's how I would read it as. Just not being greedy for something other than what's happening is conveying the true way. It is to give away unneeded belongings to someone you don't know. That's like a straightforward and very practical way. Like we have this box of outside on the bench there, right, for Mexicans crossing the border. Someone's collecting, extra toothpaste and stuff like this for people that we don't know. To offer flowers blooming on a distant mountain to the Tathagata, which is the Buddha, which is making a big leap now from just kind of like giving toothpaste to this donation, especially because it's flowers on a distant mountain. I mean, the way I hear that is, I mean, here we Liz, on behalf of all of us, very kindly makes these beautiful flower arrangements and offers to the Tathagata on this mountain. But this is like, I picture this as like, with our vast imagination and kind of spirit of infinite giving, we can imagine a whole mountain in the distance, in some other world system. A mountain covered with like flowers of every variety and color, and then offering that whole mountain of flowers to like numberless Buddhas, as many as dust motes filling the space in all directions. Maybe that kind of giving. Offer flowers blooming on a distant mountain to the Tathagata. Or again, to offer treasures you had in your former life to sentient beings. Again, it's getting hard to imagine. But in the realm where like time and space are kind of just limited conceptual constructs that are not ultimately real, we can open to like even in past lives, which are not really separate from this life, I was like a wealthy king that had like infinite riches. And I imagine, like, I'm going to be that wealthy king right now and give them all everywhere. Is that crazy? Or is it just, you know, using the powers of the mind's imagination to practice giving in all different realms, like past and future as well as present. And we say throughout space and time. Throughout past, present, and future, and throughout infinite space, where like imagine the spirit of non-possessiveness, might say, then everything is just whatever there ever is, and throughout space and time is just flowing forth naturally if we're not holding it back. Also, you know, it seems that this, what is this non-possessiveness? We can see it as like practices that we're like cultivating, because we feel possessive sometimes. So, okay, let's look at that and just try to relax around that and let go of what I'm holding on to. And then there's the kind of understanding that we can also be developing through zazen, of dropping off body and mind, of where there's actually, we're not the separate being that we think we are. I mean, this is the more profound meaning of true and boundless giving, is when we open to, like, it seems like there's me over here and you all over there, and we're these separate beings that can give to each other. But that's just the appearance, which we can open to various ways of looking at it. Like, this one mind of the universe is kind of like manifests as this body-mind experience and that body-mind experience. And we meet through our senses and our eyes and ears and so on. So it looks like the projection is out there, but really it's like, we could say, it's mind is completely interpenetrated with mind, like throughout this room and throughout all space. All the so-called separate beings are this completely interfused, intimate soup of dynamic light, right? That's so complex and has all these, like, has thoughts and emotions and strong feelings of being separate and so on. But more and more we can open to, like, it's not really that way. And when we open to this way where there's still, like, appearances of different bodies and minds, I think that's going to continue. But the more we can see, like, it's not really as separate as it seems, then the giving is just, like, already happening, I think, actually. Then it's not a practice to cultivate so much as just like, it is the interrelatedness of everything we could call giving. Right? But that's hard to open to that, where our habits over many lifetimes are very strong of like, I'm here and you're there and I have these things, I need these things, so I have just this much for you. And so then we work on it in all these different ways. Whether it is of teaching or of material, so whether it's a Dharma gift or a material gift, each gift has its value and is worth giving. Even if the gift is not your own, there's no reason to keep from giving. That's a good one, huh? I mean, we could take it like in some literal way, like Robin Hood, right? Stealing from somebody else to give to somebody else. But I would take it more as, what occurs to me as like, the gift is never really our own. Nothing's really our own, right? I mean, we have these conventional agreements in human society, pretty much everywhere, that like, that we own things, right? And we like, when you really start to like deconstruct this, but it's not that hard to deconstruct how it's pretty. It's just a temporary human construct. Like if you buy something large, like maybe a house, say, it's going to be a lot of like written kind of deeds or contracts around that, and then that this piece of paper, you exchange it for this house, right? And we agree. It's only because we agree that this means you own the house. And we're all deciding, let's just do it. Let's just agree like this because it's going to make things easier. But actually, it's pretty arbitrary. like the ants that, or the termites, let's say, that move into the house and start taking over. They don't care about the contract. They don't have the same agreement. And it's not like they're stealing our house, right? They just are in a different agreement realm. And another example that, you know, really struck me, because I was just driving across the Southwest, like through Arizona, where there's the big Navajo reservations. And it's like all this land that was, we don't know, at least I don't know exactly how the Native Americans thought about ownership, but I think they didn't have these written contracts. They maybe did have some sort of tribal agreements, probably verbal, or mind to mind, or something. But they, like, it seems like there were some fights over land, we hear, in the Native American realm, but they kind of worked things out in their own realm for some thousands of years. And then the Europeans come, and they have a different agreement about ownership. So, like, these natives don't have these contracts. So that means, like, we'll take it now. And in fact, now since we have it and we claim it, you're on it, and we'll kill you because you're on our land now. It's a different agreement. And then through this kind of European-style agreement, now we agree to give them, like, these smaller reservations within this country that used to be all Native American. And so we're like, I think that movement, which some of the people on the reservation told me, President Nixon was their favorite president because he's the one who signed these, like, Native land treaties, the first to really set up some of the reservations in a way that they really felt happy about. But it seems like it's like the American government is like sort of like, well, we have our agreements, but we kind of see your point. Probably the natives came to them and said, how can we have a different agreement? I said, well, we want to kind of honor yours. So we're going to give you, like, maybe almost half the state of Arizona. A big portion of Arizona is Navajo lands. So that's a big thing for the U.S. government to go outside their usual agreements. They don't just give that much land to anybody, right? But we're kind of like, we know you have a different agreement, but we're not going to quite go completely to yours, because then we'd have to leave or we'd have to change our way of thinking completely. So in that way, the agreements sort of meet, and it looks a little bit like European-dominated. So in this way, Dogen's saying, even if the gift is not your own, there's no reason to keep from giving. We could say physical, material things are really never our own, ultimately, except just by conventional agreement. So because they're not our own, you know, like these pieces of paper, they're not really mine. But even though they're not, I can still give them. Right? And we could also take it to mean, like, on a larger scale, again, in, like, the realm of imagination. And, you know, Vajrayana Buddhism is really big on using imagination for practice. So it's like you do these practices where you imagine, like, the entire universe, you're kind of collecting the entire universe with its four continents and Mount Sumeru and all the people in it and all the treasures and riches and beauty and nature and mountains and everything there. You kind of, like, imagine this whole realm as yours, and then give it to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So you're like, just over and over again, you're cultivating the mind of, like, infinite giving. So it's not technically, do you own this, like, four-continent world system? No, but you can, like, in some larger realm of mind, well, yeah, each of us, like, from a kind of mind-centered realm, our mind, like, encompasses the whole universe, my whole universe. I give it. I give my entire experience to all the Buddhas. Yes?
On a mundane level, I have an aunt who was a Catholic nun, and she's always wearing other people's clothes. And so kind of everybody who's around her always kind of knows, oh, she's wearing somebody else's clothes, you know. So it's kind of this loose kind of sense of, like, clothes belonging to you, because she's got her sister's clothes or her niece's clothes or somebody else's clothes.
Uh-huh.
Maybe some are hers.
And so they've given the, they all give it their clothes to her.
If she's,
oh, I see. Like borrow.
Yeah, borrow.
Oh. Interesting. Yeah.
On a daily basis, probably when she's at home, she's probably more wearing her clothes. But when you're with her, kind of a visit, she's wearing anybody's clothes.
Wow. Yeah. So.
But that's a really nice skirt. What do you know, it's Bella's. Wow, look at that.
It's like a nice way of kind of like just like sharing stuff. And within it in a loose way where it's like it can come and go, you know. What's the difference between loaning and giving? Often we loan something but we'd never get it back. Anyway, so. The question is not whether the gift is valuable but whether there's merit. Merit and virtue. We might say merit comes from this wholeheartedly giving. The merit, as we've talked about before, is like is defined sometimes as the kind of positive, joyful result of any wholesome activity. Any wholesome activity creates this a good effect, and a good effect means like happiness and well-being, and so generating merit or generating merit is like generating this positive, joyful feeling that actually like feeds our practice through. Practicing well in any kind of like giving or wholesome activity generates a good feeling. That's basic. Everyone kind of knows that. But then the Buddha Dharma makes this point about really like honoring this merit as this positive effect of wholesome activity. Honoring that is something that's really beneficial to practice. And then the Mahayana has this very interesting principle of dedicating the merit or turning over the merit. So like we practice giving, we feel happy because of that, and then we can just say, now I dedicate the merit of this giving, which is my feeling of well-being. I give my feeling of well-being to all beings. Again, it's an imagination. It's a mind training to not hold on, not be possessive of the good feeling that came from giving something away. Just continuing. I give something away, get this good feeling, I really like it. Well, let's give that away too. Oh, then even more merit comes. Give that away too. When you leave the way to the way, you attain the way. At the time of attaining the way is always left to the way. The Tao, the way, here is the, the way things are, which is not the way they appear. The way things appear is not the true way, but the way that everything is like intimately interdependent with everything else and one intimate expression beyond our concepts. That when you leave that way to the way, you attain the way. That's a nice Zazen instruction. When you leave the way to the way, you attain the way. If you try to get the way, you don't attain the way. If you try to manipulate the way, you don't attain the way. But if you just leave the way to be the way, you actually realize the way. And it's good zazen instruction, but it's also a teaching about giving, sounds like also. Yeah. When you leave the way to the way, you attain the way, that's a kind of giving. When treasure or wealth, possessions, are left just as treasure, treasure becomes giving or a gift. So that's now we're getting into like deeper levels of giving here. Right? When you let something be what it is, you're kind of giving it away. Interesting, huh? So if you maybe we have a dollar bill, right, in front of us. If we leave, let that treasure just be that treasure, like completely be itself beyond our ideas of it, which is our ideas of it include the value that it's worth 100 cents and it could be exchanged for a small chocolate bar. These days, very small one. If we like, that's kind of like like adding layers of meaning to this piece of paper with some writing on it. But if we just leave it to itself completely without all the constructed layers of meaning, it starts to dissolve as like its valuable thing used to exchange for something else. And then it becomes giving, or it becomes a gift. When you leave the dollar to its actual true nature of just being the dollar apart from our ideas about it, we've let go of it, you could say, right? We've let go of like our like, but that's valuable. That's worth half a chocolate bar. It's like, no, now it's just like, I don't know. Maybe it's just like a beautiful work of art, a little picture we could frame, but that's giving more meaning. We look at it and we actually don't know what it is anymore. We're really leaving it to what it is. What is that? Then it becomes a gift, right? And I think it becomes a gift because we're not coveting it anymore. It's like amazement. It's like light. It's like... even if it's not literally like handed to somebody, it's a gift to the universe now. It's a gift to us too. It becomes a gift when we let it be itself, the material, the treasure. You give yourself to yourself and others to others. Beautiful, huh? This is kind of giving. Give ourselves to ourselves and others to others. In fact, that's maybe the most complete giving in this essay so far, I would say. Like when we let ourselves completely just be who we are, don't try to be anyone other than we are, what a gift to the world. And when we let others, I don't know which is harder, right? To let ourselves be ourselves or let others be others. They're both hard. And actually, when one of them's hard, usually the other is hard at the same time. Like if I'm not really willing to be myself because I have to be this way for other people. In other words, I'm kind of manipulating myself into a kind of crunched version of myself in order to please somebody else. At that time, I'm going to probably start looking at other people like, why don't they be like more like I have to be?
That's why. They're always paired.
Yeah, I think they're always paired.
You always have one with the other.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that principle especially, right? If we're not willing to let ourselves be ourselves, we start trying to manipulate other people. Whereas at those rare moments, maybe when we're just like, I feel completely okay with who I am, suddenly like really annoying people can be like, actually, that's really beautiful. It's just their expression. Who they are. It's like that's their like life expression in the moment. Yeah. Yeah, it totally goes together, right? what a like profound giving that doesn't require any things, right, at all. You give yourself to yourself and others to others. The power of the causal relations of giving reaches to devas, human beings, and even enlightened sages. When giving becomes actual, such causal relations are immediately formed. So, power of inen literally means like causes and conditions. The power of causes and conditions of giving, like all the effects, the interdependent effects that extend from giving, the results of giving, the conditions that give rise to giving, that's this whole web of interdependence, and that reaches to all humans and devas, you know, the celestial beings, and enlightened sages. It connects everyone, you could say. When giving becomes actual, this letting go of separation is manifest, then these causes and conditions are immediately formed with sages and all beings. So, any thoughts, any questions, comments about giving?
Yeah, I had one. So, I'm not sure if this is going to come through clearly, so I apologize in advance if it doesn't, but maybe you guys can help me out. So, when you were talking at the beginning about how this could be considered sort of a way of gathering, or a way of gathering, like a body, mm-hmm. a social body of people, I also thought about it like, you know, chicken and the egg kind of reciprocal relationship, because I feel like if there's like a body of people that's already gathered, I'm more likely to, like the way I'm speaking right now, I wouldn't speak like this to myself. I'm looking at myself in the mirror, you know? So I'm choosing like maybe more appropriate language for the social setting, like the context of people that's already gathered. And like, I feel like I'm more likely to do what I say I'm going to do, you know, or like show up for Zazen, like, oh, well, I know Stan's going to be there, so like, I don't want to let Stan down, you know, so maybe that's a way to get me here, right? So I think maybe like these four expressions can kind of come through even when like the social body has already been gathered.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like,
and of course, as we say, if giving and kind speech are really like the center of this whole thing, you can't practice either one of those by yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of can, as Dogen's saying, especially with giving, right? Giving yourself to yourself. But for the full fruition of giving, and particularly kind speech, we need a gathering. Yeah. And yeah, you know, bodhisattvas need to be like, stay with others. And I think particularly like our Soto Zen practice is so communally based. It's so, you know, we sit together side by side like this, and we work together and chant together and eat together in a retreat. And I think that it's not just because it's practical or convenient. I think it's this to like get this bodhisattva mojo working to really get the connections, bring them alive, and especially as soon as you have a gathering of more than one. You have difficult people. So, and bodhisattvas need that. Like Shantideva, when he's talking about practicing patience, I think he's the one who says, like, difficult people are like the greatest gifts for bodhisattvas. When bodhisattvas come across a difficult person, they rejoice because now I can practice patience. Before they showed up, I actually I was kind of lacking in that bodhisattva practice.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the question of, here, you want equanimity and peace. And here, what are some specific ways, and when we talk about sitting, you know, that we really can get at this? And I have one that I've been doing lately, which I think is simple. Just on a particular day, somebody in the internet or something put out something about try one day without complaining. Make a vow, you know, and then do it, and then see what comes of that. You know, and using that kind of approach to all these different concepts. Let me try one day whether I absolutely won't judge you. You know, of course you'll fail, but I mean, you're vowing for this day, you're really going to do it, you know. For me, that becomes very useful just for my character.
That's a great one. That's a great one. I have made vows to not complain before and have failed. but it's a great practice. Yeah, yeah. Because not complaining is kind of like leaving the way to the way and leaving ourselves to ourselves and others to others. Like, that is not complaining. That's a hard one. And complaining, yeah, is a kind of holding, a kind of a non-giving in a way. We usually don't pair those up, but it's kind of related, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You're not giving.
Hmm. Yeah.
Holding.
Yeah. Holding a judgment. Opinion. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
When you mentioned that Native Americans, I have a sense that their relationship to the land, and this may be wrong, but they saw themselves as stewards.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't remember where, but in teaching the precepts, I came across the teaching of that third precept of giving, to eliminate stinginess is to teach how to skillfully acquire and keep things, which...
Mm.
You know, makes me feel like it's that stewardship.
Stewarding.
Stewarding.
Yep.
Of things. It's okay
to
have things.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to keep them.
That's nice.
Way.
Yep. That's giving things to themselves, is taking care of them, actually, appropriately. If we kind of disrespect something, we're not really giving it to itself. Giving could be, being a good steward of the earth. Giving to the earth means like taking the resources we need for life in a respectful and sustainable and renewable way could be a kind of giving, if it's done with that intention, as opposed to like taking in a kind of blind way from the earth. Yeah, that's nice. Last question.
Okay. Something reminded me, when we're talking about giving, I was thinking about it in terms of forgiveness, forgiving. I had a teacher who saw forgiveness as like giving before. A lot of times we think of like forgiveness like someone did something to me, so I'm going to forgive them after the fact. But he made it sound more like forgiveness was something that you come into human relationships with. You know, like, we're all going to mess up, we're all going to make mistakes. You know, to err is human, forgiveness is divine. So it's like when we're entering into human relationships, it seems like we might have an opportunity to give somebody the mistake that they'll inevitably make in advance. You know, instead of like, I forgive you for what you did to me last week or whatever.
I forgive you for what you're about to do.
Yeah.
I know you're going to do.
I mean, sometimes people do say like, I apologize in advance for the mistakes I probably will make.
Yeah.
But this like forgiving in advance, Yeah, maybe, like, at least in our mind, we might not want to tell people that, or we have to be careful because then we're like, I know you're really going to mess up, but... But in our mind, yeah, it means like we get ourselves, we create a kind of spirit of acceptance before people start interacting with us. Yeah, yeah. Forgiveness, meaning before, giving before. That's nice, yeah, yeah. Well, let's continue with giving next week. And does anyone want a copy who doesn't have a copy?
Page 2.
Yeah, page 2.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, I'll make some more.
We can share.
Also, it's in, this is from Moon in a Dewdrop. It's from Moon in a Dewdrop.
That's the book.
Mm-hmm.
He read a lot of
that. All right, I got one. I got one.
For now.
Oh, we could just leave them here and then pick them up next week.
Yeah, if you don't take notes on...
Then you don't study them, you know, so I like that.
If anyone wants to give them back to me and collect them next week, you can do that too.
You can.
It is. And we dedicate any merit and... any positive well-being generated through our discussion to all suffering beings throughout space and time. May they receive our wholehearted gifts. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.